Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Monday, August 15th, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this evening we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, and for the New York Star Ledger all during the week. Peter, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing good. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his work at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at fellowspotphoto.com. And also sometimes he writes for NPR.org. And you can find his books at Amazon.com as well as Peter's. Good evening, Michael.
Good evening.
So both of you have been traveling out of the tri-state area. Is that true? Michael was up in P-Town? Is that correct? And
right.
Peter was doing a Northeast tour, right? Through some of the great
rainbow tour, I like to call it, actually.
Was it an incredible success?
It always is.
Well, one show was, one show wasn't. So what can you do?
You know, Peter can always find a show to see. He can always do that. That's right. Which is really important to keep your receipts and write them all off at the end of the year. So while you guys were out of town, did you guys see the fireworks?
I don't think you mean July 4th fireworks necessarily. I think you mean...
Sondheim had his own fireworks. The pen is once again mightier than the sword, or shall we say the New York Times letters page is got quite the megaphone. Peter, why don't you start us off? Tell us what Mr. Sondheim wrote about, and let's get into this.
Well, so much for summertime and the living is easy, because there's no question that it hasn't been easy for the Porgy and Bess people getting slammed by Mr. Sondheim. Those who read all that chat, and which of us does not, notice that there were close to 300 postings on this, people giving their opinions pro and con about whether or not Sondheim should be so tough on Diane Paulus, who's directing the new Porgy and Bess, or Susan Laurie Parks, who's rewritten it, or even written it, depending on how you look at it, and Audra McDonald, who's going to be starring in it. And he, of course, came down on their making changes and thinking, in the way they were quoted at least, that they believe they can improve it. And to use the I think it's because we really never found a very good term for these first two decades of this new millennium. You know, it used to be so easy when you used to talk about bringing things into the 80s, bringing things into the 90s. But I don't know, are we bringing Porgy and Bess into the teens? I don't know. But they are doing different takes on it, and they're going to be changing the way Porgy looks in the show, and they're going to be changing the ending to some degree, and a few other things too. And Mr. Sondheim was not pleased by this. And you know, I mean, I understand both points of view. First off, next month I'm going to New Haven to see one of my favorite plays, Three Sisters. However, it's being adapted by a playwright that I haven't taken to. Many people have. She won a MacArthur Genius Grant, Sarah Rule. She hasn't shown that she has the music that makes me dance, but I am going to be interested in seeing what she has to do with Three Sisters. And it's very possible I'm going to come out as apoplectic as Stephen Sondheim is now over Porgy and Bess. But as I said last week, gee, I wish everybody would wait. I mean, there's so much time to criticize afterwards. So why bother criticizing now? I may have mentioned that all my friends who have been to Clear Day felt that they went in thinking it was going to be a disaster, and they like it very much. So today, in fact, I believe it was today, the Boston Globe came out with an editorial saying that Mr. Sondheim should wait and see, that it's that he was jumping on the gun. So one can take whatever side he cares to take, but nevertheless, this is something that has got people more excited about something Sondheim has done in a long time. And with Follies in town, we really are having quite a Sondheim summer. So we'll see what happens.
Matt, now, isn't Stephen Sondheim's reaction to Porgy and Bess really mostly driven from the Patrick Healy article that originated it? So it wasn't like Stephen Sondheim, just out of the blue decided to go after Porgy and Bess and
right, it's
production.
What he read
yeah.
there that spurred him to have his opinions. So,
well, Michael, what did you think about this whole situation?
Well, the thing is that I don't know, Peter. In this case, I think it's fine to not wait because the arrogance displayed by these women in the article is just it's just shocking, you know, and it's also a perfect storm of badness because first of all they have the incredible nerve to call this the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Now that has nothing to do with these three women. That's the estate. But as we discussed last time, that is indefensible to call it that because first of all it sounds so stupid, and more importantly, a great deal of Porgy and Bess is based on the work of Dubose Hayward, who first of all wrote the original play with his wife Dorothy. The play was called Porgy, which was then adapted by Gershwin and Mr. Hayward working together with some help from Ira Gershwin. A very small percentage of the lyrics in Porgy and Bess are by Ira Gershwin. Most of them are by Dubose Hayward. So how they got away with that to begin with is beyond me, and I don't know. I'm trying to do an article on it and interview people from the Gershwin estate. I don't know if there is a Hayward estate. If there is, I hope I can interview them. But yeah, it's just, you know, people making these comments about what's lacking in this opera that's been beloved since, you know, it opened in 1935, you know, saying that the characters aren't fully rounded out. And the Audra McDonald made some comment to the effect of that they're going to emphasize the love story between Porgy and Bess as if that hasn't been crystal clear to anyone in you know, for the past 75 years or whatever it is. And you know, changing the ending to make it more upbeat and just implying that there are all these problems with it. It's just awful. Sondheim, I think, and some others made the point, and I did last week too. The characters in Porgy and Bess are pretty much archetypes. They're not meant to be psychologically observed people with all these nuances, like you would go if you were to see a Chekhov play or a you know a modern play. I was had a funny thought. What would these women do if they you know, and so they were saying they need to give Bess a backstory and they need to explain various things about Porgy and where he's coming from. And I thought, well, what if they got their hands on the Fantastics? Would they say, you know, oh, you know, the boy and the girl, they're so generic, you know, we need to, you know, and what about that girl's mother? I mean, neither one of these kids has a mother. I think we need to add their mothers as characters or have them sing new songs from off stage, like in a dream sequence or something like that. Well, that's not what it is, people. That's not the kind of theater that it is. It's not the kind of opera that it is. So don't make uninformed statements to indicate that you're going to do things better than they were in the past and that there was something wrong with the way it was done previously. But on the other hand, you know, this is not, that part of it is not new. I mean, the new part is the actual rewriting of the text. But every time someone does a revival, they all talk about, well, you know, we're going to give it a more intimate presentation in order to focus more on the text, which really just means that they're not going to spend the money to have a full orchestra. And there have been many cases of that, including several shows by Mr. Sondheim. I would say that the Arthur Lawrence production of West Side Story went a large way, went very far towards almost destroying that masterwork. And that was with very few actual textual additions. They did translate some of the lyrics into Spanish for a while, and then they realized that was a huge mistake, and they put them back. But other than that, most of the changes were in staging, and then that opens the question: well, if you change the stage directions of a show and the basic stage directions that the authors put in there, I'm not talking about blocking, but if you change things like having Maria like throw Chino to the ground at the end of the show and point a gun at his head as if she was a mafia hitman, you know, is that changing the text? I would say in a way it is, because it was never ever intended to be that. So I think it's so interesting that this came and it's funny to me, because I guess maybe these women didn't know. Sondheim has on several occasions named Porgy and Bess as his favorite musical theater work. Now, I think part of the reason he chooses that is maybe because he thinks it's in such a class by itself that he won't be offending other people if he picks that. But I also think he loves it because it is a true, it's like something from the gods. It's hard to believe that human beings actually got together and wrote something so beautiful and so perfect. So bad choice of show to rewrite, ladies, especially from Mr. Sondheim's point of view.
I'm still interested in waiting. While I've certainly admired Diane Paulus's work and haven't admired Susan Laurie Park's work that much, I'm still interested in waiting. It's do we judge a cake that's still in the oven when we it isn't fully baked? Do we even bother tasting it? But again, as I say, I have some trepidation over Sarah Rule touching Three Sisters.
But Peter, again, you don't draw the line at rewriting the text and calling it the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess?
Oh, I see the dichotomy there. There's no question about that. I can't disagree with you there.
Okay.
But I think the Gershwin's Porgy and Bess is something the estate is demanding rather than...
Yes.
You know, so I would blame the estate more than the people who are working on the show.
Sondheim said it should be called Diane Paulus's Porgy and Bess.
Yeah, frankly, I'm all for Porgy and Bess. I don't like when titles take on the names of their authors. Edward Albee's Me, right. Myself, and I. I mean, like, we talk about Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, but and we don't mention the book writer on Flower Drum Song. One of them was Joseph Fields. And on Sound of Music, Russell Crouse and Howard Lindsay wrote the book, and it's still Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound of Music, but we don't. The official title isn't Rodgers and Hammerstein Sound of Music. I won't be surprised if someday it is, but at the moment it's not. And I do see the mistake, but I really can't get worked up over that, frankly. That's not something that bothers me very much. If the people who are controlling the estate demand that it be named after the person, I don't like it. I don't use it. I ignore it completely. Meredith Wilson's The Music Man. Or the one for the producers was hilarious. It was something like Mel Brooks' new musical, The Producers, or something like that. It wasn't just Mel Brooks, The Producers. There was more to it than that.
But I don't think they – I mean, every case is different. I don't think in those cases that they actually said that the title was Mel Brooks, The Producers.
I have a feeling I'm pretty sure that that was even the way it was – given at the Tonys every time it was nominated for something. The producer's the new Mel Brooks musical, I think, is actually the official title. And certainly, I remember seeing the list of the Tony nominees 10 years ago when The Music Man was playing, and it was definitely Meredith Wilson's The Music Man. And if we want to get really technical, a guy named Franklin Lacey was very helpful on that project and did get billing way under the title, and you could miss it, but he did get billing. So,
well, I'm looking at the IBDB right now, and something I wanted to check out was Crazy for You. Crazy for You was called the new Gershwin musical comedy. Uh-huh. The Producers is listed as the new Mel Brooks musical. Uh-huh. These are the official titles of this, and I was going back and looking at the other Gershwin things. I don't know if the Gershwin estate is trying to, you know, remind the public or build the Gershwin brand in order to bring some other shows back and have associations with the other ones. So I went back and I took a quick look at these, and so it seems like that would be the only real legitimate reason to do that, is to build the brand.
To build the brand, and also apparently to try to put things back into copyright that are about to become public domain. So that is one reason for rewriting things and reconfiguring them like Crazy for You rather than Girl Crazy, and the Gershwins, Porgy and Bess, rather than good old Porgy and Bess that everyone loved in the past. They apparently are, according to some people, they are only care about the bottom line. There are reports that there were several beautiful recordings made of the Gershwin shows in their original versions by Tommy Krasker and his crew while Ira Gershwin's wife was still alive and she overseeded. And then apparently the minute she died, the estate said, no, we don't want to do that anymore. They don't make enough money. And, basically money seems to be what they're interested in. So that is the opinion of many people on how the Gershwin estate is husbanding their properties. And it's not making a lot of people very happy. And this, I'm really kind of glad that this is blowing up in their face, because I think they need to take a long, hard look at what they're doing.
So I'm also looking at Fascinating Rhythms. Official title was
Gershwin's Fascinating Rhythm. That's right.
I wonder.
And she didn't write then. You know, I mean, and the reason is, of course, because that property meant less to him than indeed Porgy and Bess did. And of course, they didn't even do that show, Fascinating Rhythm. That was put together by other people. It wasn't like this was an old show from way back when. This was a review. So there, I guess, I'm sure that the feeling was too that that's kind of nice in a way.
I think that's different.
Yeah, it is. I'll grant you it is.
So I don't know who's running the Gershwin estate. It sounds like it's a lawyer who's not really of Broadway pedigree, but I'm just guessing there. Does anybody know?
I don't.
I don't know enough to make a definite statement, but I am trying to speak to someone, so hopefully that will happen, and I will report back. But this titles thing, yeah, I mean, we've mentioned other cases. It's not only the Gershwins, you know, Gore Vidal's The Best Man.
Yeah.
I mean, and so are you supposed to alphabetize it under G or under P?
You know how many emails I get on this subject, people saying the best little whorehouse in Texas, and the best little whorehouse goes public. Alphabetically, Best Little Whorehouse Goes Public comes before Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. But Texas was the first show, and Goes Public was the second show, and so
right.
People get a little confused there. There are so many of those that happened, and what I always loved was when The Mystery of Edwin Drood changed its title to Drood. How many apartments I went in where I saw that people had moved it from M to D? that really happened. So, I think most people are going to do what I do in terms of writing about it. I think they're going to call it Porgy and Bess and leave it at that, whether they like it or not. The Paper Mill at one point, the Paper Mill Playhouse changed its name and wanted us to print every time we did the Star Ledger.
Right.
Paper Mill, the State Theater of New Jersey. That became the new official title. Paper Mill, colon, the State Theater of New Jersey. Appearing next week at Paper Mill, colon, the State Theater of New Jersey will be, that's what they wanted. I mean, and there was no way we were going to do it. So I think there's a good possibility that authors are going to make their own feelings known and call it Porgy and Bess, like it'll lump it.
I think you're right. But some of the stuff that's happening has been almost like out of a Christopher Guest movie. I mean, it's hard to believe that these women are saying these things. The Deirdre Murray, who's adapting the music, apparently made some comment to the effect of how she always felt that Summertime was pitched too high, and wouldn't it wake the baby up if she was singing it in that key? So they're bringing it down and making it a duet with an accordion.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that kid would wake up. I really don't, and I do think it's quite a lullaby. I think it would lull the kid into listening because it's such a beautiful song. So that's why we don't hear that baby crying.
Well, so for Mr. Sondheim, on the heels of his the latest revival of one of his shows opening up on Broadway, or going into previews at least, and opening up soon, for him to do that, doesn't this open the floodgates for criticism about Follies before the official opening date?
Well, I'd like to think no, but we're all human beings. Go ahead, Michael.
No, yeah, I don't think so, because I really think he you know, I thought it was a brilliant letter or whatever.
Sure.
Posting or whatever the word
sure.
is. I think he really, and he made the, at the end, he makes the distinction. Let's see. I can hear the outraged cries now about stifling creativity and discouraging directors who want to reinterpret plays and musicals in order to bring, quote, fresh perspectives, unquote, as they are wont to say. But there is a difference between reinterpretation and wholesale rewriting. Nor am I judging this production in advance, only the attitudes of its creators towards the piece and the audience. Perhaps it will be wonderful. Certainly I can think of no better Porgy than Norm Lewis, nor a better Bess than Audra McDonald, whose voice is one of the glories of the American theater. Perhaps Miss Paulus and company will have earned their arrogance.
Mm. Well, you know, I was reading on all that chat that the only thread that got more comments than this was the discussion of the Wild Parties, the Broadway versus the Lachusa versus the Lip of Wild Parties.
I think it eclipsed those.
And also there were hundreds of comments on the New York Times website.
Sure.
Yes.
So
we're talking probably thousands of comments. I think it's wonderful.
I feel as though that I read thousands of stories about it. Forget comments. I think
sure.
that almost every theater pundit out there has written something about this.
And well, for it to make the Boston Globe editorial page, I don't mean the arts section. I mean the editorial page that tells you something. What I feel bad about is the fact that this production comes in with such an onus attached to it. I mean, the before the first preview, both in Cambridge and here, the tension is going to be so palpable.
Also, you know, there was a lot of misinformation, unfortunately, which is an unfortunate byproduct of allowing people to just post things, you know, without having them edited. Somebody said, somebody was talking about the movie, which is, you know, it's good to bring up the movie because aside from everything else, it did cut out almost all of the sung dialogue, which is apparently what's going to happen in this production. So it's not as if that has never been done before. But somebody said that in the movie that Summertime was dubbed by Marnie Nixon.
Oh,
now,
really?
I mean, come on, you know, do some research. Where did you get that from? You know, that's like a drug-induced hallucination or something. Marnie Nixon did not sing Summertime in the movie. And also, on another short memory span note, as I said, you know, this Trevor Nunn production of Porgy and Bess not only played in, I believe it was Glyndebourne, but also was televised and is available on DVD. And it's as if people have forgotten the fact that in that production, also, the goat was eliminated and Porgy gets around by means of a cane, not a goat cart. I don't know. It's surprising me sometimes how short people's memories are when it comes to things like this.
Well, we will see, as it were, and it's made for a interesting August, which is usually very quiet.
Yeah.
Also happening this week is Catch Me If You Can is put up a closing notice for September 4th and starting a national tour in the fall of 2012. I was surprised about this. What do you guys think?
I was shocked. I was really shocked. I thought that Catch Me If You Can was getting good word of mouth. Certainly people I know who saw it were having a very good time. And I thought the album would help them too, because so many people really have fallen in love with the score as a result of the album coming out. So I felt they were going to be all right. But obviously, after Labor Day, they just don't have much in the kitty. So as a result, they're going to have to cry uncle. But that's pretty fascinating to me. And I do wonder, though, if some of this has to do with the fact that the Broadway audience has changed so much that they're not interested in hearing songs that sound like early 60s non-rock songs, which much of the score is. And I wonder if it strikes people as just terribly old-fashioned, and that's why it's not building up an advance sale. At least that occurred to me.
Michael?
Oh, I hope that's not the reason, Peter.
Yeah, me too.
it might be. I think there was enough... you know, there's enough of an audience of all different age groups and sensibilities, hopefully, to go around for that kind of music. Catch Me If You Can is a heartbreaker for me, as I think I've said before, because I don't think it works, but it's the most honorable failure that I can imagine. The score is terrific. It's just, I think they made a huge mistake when they decided on this framing device of a TV variety show, and they didn't know how to make it work, and they didn't know how to get out of it, and they also weren't even consistent in their use of it. But there is so much. I mean, you look at Catch Me If You Can, and then you look at Baby, It's You, and they're not even in the same universe as far as integrity and talent. So one of them, I'm not at all sorry to see it close, except for the fact of people losing their jobs. But sure. You know, that always is the case. The other one, I'm really sad about, Catch Me If You Can. I'm just sorry it wasn't better than it wasn't as good as it could have been, and that there were some mistakes made, but it's very, very honorable work. And I do think, I hope it will have a life, but I mean, one reason it might not have much of a life is because it's very, well, I mean, it would be hard to do it correctly without spending a lot of money. we'll see. But I hope the score has a life anyway.
Yeah, it's sad to say that whenever a tour is announced, and one so far in advance, many people thought there was a misprint, that they must have meant that it was going to leave Broadway and go directly on tour to Providence, where they're claiming to open next year. But traditionally, such mentions of tours, especially on a faraway date, are meant to save face, to make it look like the show was more successful than it was. But right. We'll see. Margot Lyon's a great producer, and it's entirely possible she's going to give it a second chance. And, you know, I mean, even Big, which was at that point the biggest failure in the history of Broadway, losing $10 million, even Big did go on tour. It was a very much cut down tour, but it was a reworked tour. And to my mind, and I'm in the minority on this, I didn't think it was nearly as good as the original. I'm talking about the writing now, what they what they changed. I'm not talking about production values of the cast or anything like that, but I am talking about the show itself. So, that went on tour, you know. So, it ran approximately the same length of time that Catch Me If You Can will have run. So I hope the nation does get to see it.
I was amazed but delighted that I'll never forget that apparently the tour of Caroline or Change did much better than the Broadway production. And I don't know, it's for some reason it doesn't strike you as the kind of show that would. I mean, it's so serious. It's a wonderful show, but it's very, very serious and very, I don't know if dark's the right word, but it's very intense and very emotional. So I don't know if they market it better?
I think that shows like that are smartly produced, because that might, Caroline or Change might not be the type of show that would merit somebody getting on a plane and coming to New York to go see. But if you're a diehard theater fan and you see Caroline or Change is going to play in the local touring house versus going to see the 14th production of you know, Joseph, you're going to go see Caroline or Change. And you know, it's smartly produced that it does the quick hits in and out of the major markets and fills up shows. Whether, you know, if they can't bring the people to New York, then go to the people out all over everywhere and make sure everybody sees it. I think it's really good. The Catch Me If You Can, the most surprising thing to me is that Aaron Tveit did not become the huge star that I thought he was going to become in this show.
Me too. I went to a press preview and I thought he was all set. And I thought, frankly, that he would be embraced for another reason, too. It's the classic Broadway situation of having an important supporting role in one musical and then going on to the starring role in the next. It's a hallowed tradition. Gwen Verdon did it, and so many others did, too. So I really thought this was his time and his chance. And I thought he was marvelous in the show. I really did.
Well, all three of us seem to definitely agree on that. And I think, honestly, you know, but I've read people say that they thought he was bland, and my response to that is, I think you have no understanding of what the show and the character is supposed to be. I mean, he's not supposed to be like incredibly quirky and interesting in the way that Norbert Leo Butz is. He's supposed to be, unless I'm misreading the play, he's supposed to be this very attractive guy who can be a chameleon and kind of slip into these various roles. If he was quirky, you know, in the way that Norbert is, he wouldn't be able to do that. And so I think that people don't understand what that role is supposed to be. And I thought he was great in Next to Normal, and he has a phenomenal voice. And I think the reason he didn't get more accolades and more award nominations or whatever for this is just because of the nature of the role itself. I really do think that that's true. I hope he has a brilliant career, and I'm kind of sure that he will. I hope he will.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of his, and from Next to Normal into this, I thought that he actually grew, and it was interesting to see his trajectory unfold right in front of us. Another leading man's trajectory has changed, announced this evening, with Reeve Carney, our own Spider-Man, is going to play Jeff Buckley in a film. And so it seems that his star is taking off, that he's made the most of the Spider-Man thing, and he's going to play Jeff Buckley, and we'll see where this goes from here. But he's another person that was plucked out of obscurity and given a great opportunity, and he's made the most of it. So we'll see what happens. Another thing I wanted to mention this evening is that there was a press release out of the Rodgers and Hammerstein organization that write it down in your calendars now. On April 24th, 2012, they're going to have a Sound of Music presentation at Carnegie Hall. Tickets are going to go on sale, and it's going to be a benefit for Carnegie Hall, and it's a one-night-only thing, and lots of people always find out about these things as it's ramping up, you know, in March or April of 2012, you start hearing about it, and the tickets will all be sold out. But if you're a listener to this podcast, you'll get your ticket tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. And yes. although we don't know the cast yet, bear in mind that when they did South Pacific at Carnegie Hall, it was Brian Stokes Mitchell and Reba McEntire and Jason Danieli. And when they did Carousel, it was Hugh Jackman. And I can't immediately think of who the other people were.
But nevertheless, Hugh Jackman.
Hugh played all the roles.
That's right. His fans would have liked to have seen that amazingly. Sure, absolutely. So it's going to be interesting to see who shows up at The Sound of Music. Is it going to be the hardcore theater goer? In a way, I suspect not, because most of us have seen Sound of Music more than once. It may very well be fans of the movie, and there are millions upon millions of those. So I have a feeling it's not going to be the same old tired faces you've seen since the day one at Carnegie Hall that night. I think it's going to be much more of a cross-section of Americana.
Do we want to guess on a Maria?
Well, you know who just leapt into my mind is Laura Benanti, who
did it.
Yeah, she took over in the just at the end of the run of From the Luker, last yeah. revival. Yeah, and apparently she was amazing.
I saw her do it, and I got to tell you, I mean, Richard Chamberlain was playing Trap at that point, and the way she held stage with him in that scene where she tells him off, you know, the one about kids love you, you know what scene I mean. Anyway, she was riveting. I mean, she was not the least bit intimidated that he was this famous person. She was not. She was there to do her job, and boy, did she do it. So, Laura Benanti would be nice.
Well, I'll venture to guess here that if it's April 24th, 2012, she would have to be in rehearsal for a few weeks at least beforehand, and she's got that television series on NBC. So I would imagine she's not going to be able to do it. I'm just guessing here, unless the television series bombs, but Laura Benanti as a Playboy bunny, I'm hoping that it plays for years and years to come.
Yeah, we're not wishing that on her. We want her to be successful.
Yes, and that she brings to Kelly O'Hara.
Yeah. So, I have a feeling it's going to be a very different audience that night from the one that we usually see. Or I guess what I mean is more of a Carnegie Hall audience than a Broadway audience. So, but we shall see what we shall see. I was a little surprised they chose it. A little.
Yeah, and of course with The Sound of Music, there's always the situation where the show version is in some ways quite different from the movie version. So I wonder how they'll finesse that in this case. Sometimes they add the movie songs and do all of them.
Sure.
I don't think that's what they're going to do in this case. But I love those songs that are cut from the movie.
Me too.
How Can Love Survive?
And No Way to Stop It. Oh, they're terrific. Though there's always a difference of opinion on Ordinary Couple versus Something Good. I prefer Something Good, but I know a lot of people who don't. Do you?
Yeah.
I think it's a beautiful song. Beautiful. So... So anyway, I have to say right now, I'm not planning to go. You know what I mean? So, and I have a feeling there are going to be people who feel the way I do because I'm no stranger to the Sound of Music on stage.
Well, you may, you know, but Peter, you may go depending on who the cast is.
Yeah, the play's the thing, you know? I mean, it's very rare for me to be seduced by performances rather than the property itself. So I'm very much into the writing of a show rather than the performing of a show. So, I mean, yes, plays are meant to be played, of course. But nevertheless, I don't know if there's anybody who could really get me to go. And I'm not averse to it. I mean, you know, really. I like Sound of Music amazingly. I think it's very moving and very well constructed. And, you know, Do Re Mi takes a lot of heat, but I mean, really, what a brilliant idea for a song. I mean, come on, really. You know, stop it with it's so sweet and so saccharine and all that kind of stuff. If you were writing a show and you thought of that idea, you'd dance around your living room for 20 minutes in glee, you know? So, I mean, you would. And, I mean, you got to give these guys credit. That's a smart number. I think it's one of the all-time great production numbers, and I'm not afraid to say it. Though it's funny, just this weekend when I was with friends, it came up, the famous Pauline Kael criticism of the movie, you know, where she says, wasn't there one little Von Trapp child who didn't want to perform for Papa's parties or threw up before a performance and a few other things too. It's a very on target criticism. You know, it does seem that everybody seems to be very much enthusiastic about doing everything as a unit in that show. And while I'm an only child, I dare say that families with seven brothers and sisters is a little more dissension among the ranks. So
I love in the show version that would make me go to see the concert is the nuns' choruses, which are they're in the film, but they're just not. It's not quite the same thing. They open the show, and then at the end, there's a magnificent choral version of "Climb Every Mountain" that the Mother Abbess starts, and then all the nuns join in. And it's if you listen to it on the cast album, it's quite breathtaking. So I'm already thinking about that.
Yeah.
Well, I went
to Catholic schools. I've seen plenty of nuns. So it's not going to happen again. So.
Peter, to answer your point that you brought up before, I'm one of nine children, and never in the history of my family have we been able to get two of us together to sing a song. So, Gary Griffin from The Color Purple is going to be directing the production, and Rob Fisher is the musical director. And I'm looking at the cast is going to be announced later. There's going to be a gala pre-concert dinner. If you want gala benefit tickets, they're going to go on sale this fall. If you want to receive an invitation, please email specialevents@carnegiehall.org. That's specialevents@carnegiehall.org. And then they're going to have a limited number of concert-only tickets will be available to Carnegie Hall subscribers and donors beginning Friday, December 9th, and general ticket sales go on December 16th, so mark your calendars. Alrighty, let's move forward onto our next agenda item, which is also Rodgers and Hammerstein. Just thought we'd mention it that the South Pacific production from the U.S. here, their most recent one up at Lincoln Center, is opening up in London at the Barbican. And I wonder how that's going to be received. Do you have a quick 30 seconds on what your guesses are?
Well, I don't. Of course, we don't know, but it's interesting to note that the last London production was, I think, wasn't it Trevor Nunn also, Peter?
Oh, I think there was one. Yeah, sure. Lauren Kennedy was in it, right.
And
yeah.
they really reconfigured it. One thing that they did was to follow the idiotic lead of the film version and open it with the scene of the scene on the beach with all the CBs and all of that stuff. And then all that was followed then by the introduction of Nellie and Emile, I believe. And that was probably something that most people would say was not a good idea. So London will now be seeing it again in its original form. You know, there's a, as I'm sure Peter knows, there is a film of the original the original London production right. that was done basically for archival purposes. It's really not good quality. A lot of it is in long shot, but it is Mary Martin. It's unfortunately not Ezio Pinza.
It's Wilbur Evans. The problem with it, the strange thing about it, is the fact that it's not filmed in front of an audience, and it feels very sterile. I think it was a dress rehearsal, and you don't get any excitement from the audience, and lines just hang there long enough that you could really hang laundry on them. So it's quite a curiosity. It's the type of thing that all of us, when we heard about, say, I want a copy of that. I don't know if any of us ever got through it. I know I didn't.
No, you're right. It's very just the lack of an audience reaction makes it seem endless.
Yeah, and arid.
Yeah.
So more Sahara Desert than South Pacific. So, but I saw a revival of South Pacific in London, long before that, maybe 87. That rings a bell. But Gemma Craven was Nellie Forbush, and she was very good. It was a very nice production. Quite nice indeed.
All right.
So.
All right. So coming back over the pond, Peter went north to the, let me try this, Winnipesaukee Playhouse? Winnipesaukee?
Yeah, Lake Winnipeg. If you were from New England, you'd have no problem pronouncing that word because Lake Winnipesaukee is a big vacation area. And what was fascinating to me was the fact that they decided to do Gigi. Now you're saying, well, come on, you know, the Gigi gets done. Not this one. This is the original Anita Loos play that was done on Broadway in 1951 and made a star of Audrey Hepburn. That's where she really caught fire. And the Gaston in that production, by the way, was Michael Evans. You're pardoned if you don't know who he is. I do because he did The Road Company of Mary Mary, one of my favorite comedies. He also was a Higgins on Broadway for some time. But if you want to find out who Michael Evans is, watch the Bye Bye Birdie movie, the 1963 one with Anne Margaret. And this is the guy that Rosie tries to make Albert jealous with. So Claude Paisley, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's who that is. So he was Gaston in the original production of Gigi. But it's really quite fascinating to see this play because it's very, very different from the movie that we all know and love. Now, in 1949, there was a movie ostensibly made from this play, and you figure, well, it's going to be a great deal like it. No, it isn't. It's very different. So even if you see that 1949 movie, which is hazardous in a way because it has subtitles, but there are so many scenes with people in bed with white sheets, and so many people sitting in restaurants with white tablecloths, and so many people wearing white dresses, you know, especially Gigi, because she's a young girl, and young girls wear white, as Sondheim taught us in A Weekend in the Country. So, it's hard to read the subtitles. In fact, when it was done in Turner Classic Movies, Robert Osborne even apologized for the titles in advance, saying, you know, you're gonna have a problem with it, you know. But it's far more adult here than either one of those movies made it. For one thing, there is one character added and one subtracted. There is no Marie Chevalier character, but who is there is Gigi's mother. So it's not a case of Hermina Gingold being, depending on how you look at it, I mean, I'm not even sure if she's a grandmother or if she's an aunt. To me, Mamita, I know, maybe she's the mother, but Gigi has a mother in the original play who is a minor player in operetta, in the opera comique, and it's very much like Madame Armfeldt and Desiree in their relationship, because Madame Armfeldt is contemptuous of her daughter's achievements, so to speak. There's a scene where the mother is rehearsing her role, which simply means saying no. She's asked a question, she sings no, you know, and asked another question, no, you know, and finally the her mother, the Hermione Gingo character, says, "Will you stop learning that two-letter word and listen to me?" You know, so which is really quite good. There's also a maid and a butler who have a lot to do. In fact, it's the maid who says about Gaston, "Poor boy, poor boy," which is the opening lines of "I'm glad I'm not young anymore," the honorary song. They also have a scene, the butler and the maid, with champagne. And I had to wonder if the night they invented champagne was originally written for them. It's not impossible that that's what happened. So, but what's really fascinating is that Gigi tells off Aunt Alicia in no uncertain terms at the end of the show, even says, "You're a failure." And this is scandalous for a young girl to be saying this to her aunt. You know, "You don't know what love is. I shouldn't listen to you. What do you know?" That type of thing. It's also a great deal has to do with the fact of a telephone comes into the house, and it's all about getting used to the telephone. There's a great deal with that. In fact, Aunt Alicia gets on the phone and says, "Let me speak to," I forget who it is, but "let me speak to," and the operator says, "The line is busy." And she says, "It's busy? Okay, then tell me what she's saying." Now, that's a good line that she fully expects that the operator will listen into the conversation and say, "Here's what she's saying." And in fact, when the operator will not tell her what she's saying, she actually says, "Oh, you little bitch." And it was astonishing, because up till now it was this charming, light as air, frothy show, and it got a little ribbled there, and it gets ribbled at the end. Gigi actually says about Gaston to her relatives, he could not say that he wanted to go to bed with me. And you certainly don't hear that in that 1959 movie. It's interesting, too, that she calls him Tonton. You know, he's uncle in the other properties, but Tonton, of course, means uncle, and the girl who played Gigi was marvelous. She really was. I have the program here, so you may as well give her credit. Her name is Brady Lynch. And when she started, she had the opposite problem the most Gigi's have, that Leslie Caron has and that the woman in the French movie has. They look too old. They just do, you know, and they're romping around, and they look a little ridiculous. But it's all because later they got to look glorious, you know what I mean? And But here it's somebody who really seemed like a little girl, and you worried about the end of the show. Uh-oh, she's such a precocious little girl. She ain't going to be able to handle the end when she's supposed to be glamorous and glorious. Ah, but this play isn't interested in her looking glamorous and glorious. What this play is interested in doing is making her have the brains. It's not the beauty. It's the brains that she shows at the end of the show, that she's matured in that way. And that's very special. And you really believe that she's certainly on her way. So because this play is never done, I had to get up there and bless the director, Neil Pankhurst, who's the one who found it, and said, "You know, in a way, it sort of reminds me of The Importance of Being Earnest." And when I read that in the credits, having just watched the French movie and the musical movie, I said, "Gee, I don't see that." But, you know, there are some very Lady Bracknellish things about Aunt Alicia. So who knows? Maybe we'll see a revival with Brian Bedford playing Aunt Alicia. It's fine with me.
You know, it's interesting. The two biggest Lerner and Lowe successes were My Fair Lady and Gigi. And in both cases, they're not really based on the original source material. They're based on the movies. My Fair Lady is even credited. It's not really based on the play by Shaw. Based on the film, which Shaw wrote the screenplay, but there were a lot of changes, and it was much more cinematic, and it had more of a, you know, a different narrative
to go the races
line to it.
Yeah.